You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
We're titling the subject of this study, The Deconstructing of the Sin of Cynicism. We're speaking, of course, in Christian terms, that cynicism is itself a sin. Where does cynicism originate from? Well, the origin story is from Diogenes of Sinope in the 4th century BC. And Diogenes was a colorful character, to say the least. And as the founder of cynicism, he left us no extant or existing writings. Instead, what he preferred to do is act out his cynicism, act out his philosophy. So it's something of a philosophical theater, that he would go into the public square and he would act out what he was trying to show. Some things that we learn from historians at the time is that Diogenes of Sinope was incredibly suspicious of human nature. In one incident, he brought a lantern lit in the middle of the noonday sun, walking through the town square, and he kept repeating, "I am looking for an honest man. I am looking for an honest, I am looking for an honest man." And everyone said, "Why are you doing that?" And he says, "Because I can't find one." Quite suspicious. He loved dogs more than people. In fact, he was called Diogenes the Hound. And whenever you see statues of Diogenes, it's always with a cute little puppy. Of course, in the ancient world, the hounds were more like cats today, so they were just vicious, evil creatures. They were strays. They would eat anything that they could. And Diogenes just loved dogs. In fact, the Greek term for dog is kuon, K-U-O-N, upsilon O-N. And this is actually the root from which we get the term cynic, cynic. He rejected authority. At one point, historians dispute this, but I'm going to choose to believe it. At one point, Alexander the Great visited Greece, Corinth, Greece, which was sort of Diogenes' main center of operations. And Alexander the Great cast his long shadow over Diogenes, who was laying naked in the sun. And Alexander kicked his foot and he said, "Ask me for anything that you like, and it will be yours." To which Diogenes replied, "Get out of my sunlight." Dude was getting a tan and he's just like, "Yeah, I need something. Get out of the way. You're blocking my sun. I'm going to get a line here, you know." Well, Alexander was quite impressed with this. And so he left that encounter with Diogenes and he was walking away and he said, "You know, if I were not Alexander, I would be Diogenes." And Diogenes said, "If I were not Diogenes, I also would wish to be Diogenes." He rejected the gods, plural. Of course, the pantheon or the polytheism of ancient Greco-Roman thinking. At one point, he was asked if he believed in the gods, to which he replied, "How can I help from believing in them when I see such a god-forsaken wretch as you?" Cynicism. He rejected social norms. He was incredibly vulgar. He was disgusting. He was dirty. He would walk around buck naked constantly. He was dubbed Socrates gone mad. He used to go into Plato's lectures and eat loud food, like the equivalent of Doritos, and sit in the front and and people just, he drove people crazy because they said, "Well, he's crazy." One person came up to Diogenes and said, "You know, don't you know that people are laughing at you behind your back?" To which he replied, "Very likely do the asses laugh at them, but as they don't care for the asses, so neither do I care for them." Asses meaning donkeys, so don't get offended. But you should be offended because he's an offensive guy. That's Diogenes. That's our character here. People threw bones at him like a dog as he spent all his days with dogs and he loved dogs and he slept with the dogs. And so they said, "You're a dog," and they were at a party and they were throwing bones at him like, "You're a dog. There you go. Rough, rough." And Diogenes played a dog's trick and drenched them. I don't mean like drench them. I mean like drenched them. And he said, "If you're going to treat me like a dog, then I'm going to act like a dog." Well, to summarize, this is your founder, you cynic. This is your founder. Behold the man. Now, he and his philosophy, classical cynicism, isn't identical with contemporary or modern cynicism today. You know, for example, if you saw a man buck naked urinating on a person in public, the first adjective that you would use would most likely not be cynical, right? However, what we're seeing here is kind of a window into where cynicism arose. According to Diogenes and his contemporaries, really, he was seen as this really incredibly bright, brilliant, intelligent, witty, and confident man. He used his keen intellect to incisively speak to the issues of the day and to constantly question the social norms of marriage and government and religion and the sports and materialism and so forth. And so Diogenes is kind of an archetype of what later cynicism became. Now, is any of this sounding familiar? A person who is coming off as witty and confident and able to use their keen mind to see through the issues of the day, this is where we find ourselves today. To give a contemporary definition of cynicism, we would say that cynicism is the belief that people, organizations, and authorities are mainly driven by selfish motivations or motives. It is the belief that people, organizations, and authorities are mainly driven by selfish motivations. Now, when we use that word belief, it can be a little bit vague, a little bit nebulous here, and so I'm just going to offer a synonym here, interpretation. The interpretation of people, organizations, authorities, and that these are mainly, chiefly driven by selfish motivations. So, if you're standing next to a cynic, and I know we don't have any cynics in this room, that's why it's so full, but you've got a lot of friends that you need help with. But if you were to stand next to a species of cynic, and you were to look at the data, what did he say? Well, what did she say? What did they do? What was the report? Well, what was the verbiage? What was the tone? We would all be looking at the same data. But the cynic has the narrative or the interpretation to understand the data differently. So, jurors are brought into a court of law to hear all of the facts, the forensic evidence and the legal evidence, and then they're asked to make a decision or an interpretation of the data. Is she guilty? Is she innocent? And so too, when it comes to cynicism, this is an interpretation, as I say, that adverb is important, mainly driven by selfish motivations. Dick Keyes, in his excellent book, Seeing Through Cynicism, he's the director of LaBrie Fellowship in Massachusetts. He defines cynicism in this way. He says, cynicism has to do with seeing through and unmasking positive appearances to reveal the more basic underlying motivations of greed, power, lust, and selfishness. To see through. That's what he said. But what did he mean? That's what she did, but what was her motive? That's what they're claiming the vision is, but what's really driving it? To see through all of this to the other side, to pull back the thin veneer of the mask, to really see, to see through into the heart. This is Keyes's point. And of course, I don't need to belabor this point, but we live in an age of cynicism. Public trust in government. Back during the time of Eisenhower, Kennedy, LBJ, the trust was somewhere hovering between 70 to 75%. The most Americans just trusted the government. Right or wrong, we're not saying that we're giving this some kind of a moral claim or that we think that's right or that it's wrong. We're just saying, sociologically speaking, at that time in this place, that's what people felt about the government. Then we had Nixon. We had the president being caught lying. And then he said, not that I was wrong, he called it famously a mistake. I made a mistake. That lowered trust in the government. Then we had Carter, 1979. This would have been right during the Iran crisis, if you remember. This lasted for 444 days, and day in, day out, just watching the television, seeing these terrorists hold people hostage. Well, this lowered the trust in government. Goes back up during Reagan, probably because it was the Cold War. At the height of the Cold War, war usually imbibes a sense of trust in government because who else are you going to trust in at that time? Then, as we see, Bush 41, Clinton, this would have been the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Again, we had a president lying to us. And then finally, George Bush number 43, this spiked right around 2001, September 11th. Public trust increased during a time of war. And as you can see, this has just had a precipitous decline. Whether you're on the left or the right, I don't care. Either Obama, Trump, whatever. People have a lower trust in government right now than ever before. What about trust in key leaders and key groups of leaders today? Scientists are at the top, elected officials are at the bottom. That makes sense. But look at this, religious leaders right in the middle with all the scandals and with all of the different philosophical attacks against religion. And really, there's not a lot of philosophical attacks that are recent from the atheist and agnostic communities, the old hardline atheists. They had the arguments. Today, what we have is more of a smear campaign against religion. It's a mockery against religion in general and Christianity in particular. And so religious leaders, as leaders of this made-up stuff of spirituality, they're thought to be held in contempt and with distrust. Well, there's no news there, and I don't want to keep pressing the point. This is the air that we breathe, is cynicism. Why is it that all of our favorite characters on television, all of our favorite stand-up comedians, they're all cynical to the core? Why is that? This is the air that we breathe, but the problem is it's asphyxiating us. As the old proverb says, if you want to know about water, you don't ask the fish. Well, why? Well, because talking to a fish would be stupid, because they don't talk. But two, because fish are immersed in water. All fish know is water. They know nothing besides water. And so for many of us, when we hear cynicism, all we can think about is this is just normal. Like being on the highway and you're driving 65 miles an hour and then you get up to 80 and then that seems normal and then you're pushing it to 95 and 110. They call that being velocitized. That all of a sudden going back down to even 80 would feel like you're just trudging along. In our culture, we have been velocitized in the area of cynicism, where this just seems completely normal. Well, I myself am a recovering cynic. What does it have to offer? You know, if crime doesn't pay, why are there criminals? If cynicism doesn't offer anything, why are there cynics? Oh, it has benefits, to be sure. For one, it's quite easy to validate and just as difficult to disprove. Easy to validate. Just hop on your social media. Look at your news feed. Recently, within the last couple years, Bill Hybels, one of the great Christian leaders in the United States, turns out he had been lying for decades. For decades. Sexual immorality, adultery, liar, cheater. It was a fraud. That's what it was. More recently, Ravi Zacharias, they did a complete investigation. I can't believe the people that came to his defense after that investigation. How dare you? How dare you? When we have concrete evidence. Oh, we don't want to say anything about the dead. We wouldn't want to say anything about Robbie now that he's dead. He can't defend himself. Well, does that mean we can't say anything about Hitler? About Stalin? They're dead. We do plenty of investigations there. Oh, the investigation for Robbie. It was nauseating to read. I read the whole thing. Sexual assault. Multiple women. Spiritual abuse, right on down the line. I mean, he was one of my heroes. Very easy to validate. Some of the people that you trusted in the most. And all it takes is one. And you're crushed. It's also very difficult to disprove. Because when we say, what I believe is, most spiritual leaders in the Christian community out there, I have a lot of confidence in them. Unless I have reason to think otherwise. You follow that? Whoa, so you just have blind faith in every Christian leader? No, that's not what I said. I trust them unless I have reason to think otherwise. The cynic would say that everyone should be held under the microscope. Everyone should be held guilty until proven innocent. And we can never know if anyone is ever considered to be good. And so no matter how many good examples you give, all the cynic needs to do is just give one bad example, which spreads like a contagion, a mutation across all that's going on in the Christian world. It's also a negative statement. Very difficult to falsify this. Not impossible, but difficult. Because they're standing on no turf. They're standing on no ground, philosophically speaking. They're not saying, I don't believe in God. That would be a knowledge claim that you could defeat. Or, I don't know if there's a God. That would be a knowledge claim that you could argue. They're just saying, be suspicious. They're just saying, trust no one. They're just saying, everybody lies. How do you disprove such a claim? Moreover, cynicism has a benefit because it exposes hypocrisy, naivete, and blind optimism. We need more of this. To expose hypocrites. To expose people who are naive. The world is a dangerous place. You know that. And so I hope no one walks out of here thinking, well, it's just, you know, we should all just be more optimistic. No, that's not the message at all. We shouldn't be optimistic at all because there's real dangers in our world. Came across this article. It was actually a blog post from 2018 in the month of April. This couple had traveled across the world on their bikes. They had this to say. They said, you watch the news and you read the papers and you're led to believe that the world is this big, scary place. People, the narrative goes, are not to be trusted. People are bad. People are evil. People are axe murderers and monsters and worse. I don't buy it. Evil is a make-believe concept that we've invented to deal with the complexities of fellow humans holding values and beliefs and perspectives different than our own. It's easier to dismiss an opinion as abhorrent than strive to understand it. Badness exists for sure, but even that is quite rare. By and large, humans are kind, self-interested sometimes and myopic sometimes, but kind, generous and wonderful and kind. No greater revelation has come from our journey than this. In a grief-stricken act of irony, in a terrible moment of grief, 3 months later, after they made this blog post, members of ISIS surrounded this couple with SUVs, stabbed them to death, and ran over their dead corpses. Why do I bring this up? Because there are real dangers. There are real dangers. And if we're going to have the view that we just need to be more optimistic and nothing's wrong and everything's fine, that is light years away from what the Bible teaches. There is hope. There is reason for security. There is reason to be content in God. Absolutely. But to, in some sort of blanket way, give our trust away to other people, that is so far from biblical teaching. It's out there in the parking lot. Another benefit of cynicism, of course, would be that it gives a feeling of elitism. Elitism. To be in the little circle, to be of those in the know. Oh, all you out there, you sheep. Oh, so you're following that idea. You're following that vision. Oh, that's real. That's cute. Yeah. And it gives the sense that I'm in the know. This, consequently, is at the heart of every conspiracy theory. What really drives conspiracy theories? You might say the evidence. Wrong. That's not the case. Motive. Motive. Listen to your friends who tell you conspiracy theories and look for what they're saying. Listen closely. We didn't land on the moon in 1969. Why not? Well, where's the evidence? Well, we've got all these pictures we can look at from different directions. I've seen all of it. It's baloney. Okay, but, see, during the Cold War, we wanted to get up to the moon, and Sputnik was already up, and, you know, a motive to want to show the Soviets that we were superior by landing the first man on the moon. And so that's why the whole thing happened in Arkansas by some kind of a television crew. Motive. Motive. 9/11 was an inside job. Where's the evidence for that? Well, I've looked through that. But they say, after 9/11, that gave us a free pass into Afghanistan and then into Iraq. And yeah, it's the motive that we wanted to get at the oil. That's the motive behind it. So therefore, the government killed something like 3,000 people on that day. Motive. And so it makes me feel superior because I'm part of the elite. And only I know this and no one else knows that. Incidentally, the people that came up with that conspiracy theory, guess who they're blaming 9/11 on? The Jews. The Jews. It's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. That's what that is. We invaded Muslim countries because the Jews are in control of the world. I really hope that last sentence doesn't get taken out of context online. Cynicism protects us from pain, I'm never going to get my hopes crushed if I don't have hopes. I can never be betrayed if I never make a friendship. I can never fail if I never try. You don't think that this is a benefit? This creates basically an insulation around the heart to make you impervious to pain. Moreover, it excuses my apathy. There's a moral dimension that's at play with cynicism. What's that? Well, if all causes are counterfeits, and all people are phony and fraudulent and fake, well then, it would actually be wrong of me to participate in something that's furthering someone else's selfish, self-absorbed agenda. And so I wouldn't want to like get up in the morning and put my pants on and try to like do something for the world or for others. I wouldn't want to like be part of someone else's cause. I don't want to be a cog in the machine, especially when the machine is just there to basically generate some kind of a selfish agenda for somebody else. And so I play World of Warcraft and eat Doritos all day. Well, congratulations. That's great. Cynicism has a lot going for it. Yes, it does. I don't believe this is the way. I'm convinced this is a sin to be cynical, as we're defining it, Why not be a cynic? For one, cynics use reason selectively. Let me see if I can explain this well. Cynics are hurt. They're in pain. They've been betrayed. And so all of that pain, we could picture that as a circle, like in a Venn diagram, like this. Yet they use the language of reason and evidence and argumentation to advance their point over here. And there is some overlap in that they see things that are real and they see things that are true, but even though the real issue is the pain and the hurt and the betrayal and the distrust, they're using the language of reason to advance their points, but they use it selectively, It's not that they're coming up with a coherent, comprehensive view. They're just using reasons to advance their own perspective. You see, cynicism gets somewhat of a free pass on rigorous reflection and reasonable reflection. To the cynic, everything is just deemed obvious or self-evident. When you talk to the cynic, why aren't you involved in whatever? Why aren't you moving toward relationships? Why don't you choose to make a step of love and open up your heart to others? Oh my gosh. It's just obvious. Can't you see? Can't you see that everyone around here is just so screwed up and selfish? Well, what is that? That's not an argument. That is not an argument. That's what we call an assertion. So, I could say the sky is pink. I could say that the sky is purple. I could say that the sky is seafoam green. All right? Those are what we call assertions. I could make any assertion that I want, but I'm not backing it up with any kind of evidence. This is precisely what the cynic does. Just to state as self-evident truth, you want to talk about blind faith. What if Christians did that? What if we just said it's just obvious that everything in the Bible is true and Jesus is real and God is real and the Trinitarian God has existed for eternity and you just have to believe it, and I can't believe that you wouldn't. We're going to adopt the cynical worldview on that kind of evidence? They make logical leaps. Clinicians and psychologists refer to this as magnification. So, because you have a liar like a Bill Hybels, because you have a sexual offender like a Ravi Zacharias, which is evil, which is sinful and evil, because you can make that case for one person, they make the logical leap that that is the truth for all people. All people are just like that. That's a logical leap. They use rhetoric, not reason. Now, I don't know if you know this. I have no problem with rhetoric. In fact, I kind of like it. I like listening to stand-up comedians. I like listening to good public speakers. But the problem is when you replace reasons with rhetoric. How boring would it be just to listen to a case for something, an Intelligence Squared debate, a TED Talk, whatever. And you're listening to this, and all it is this bland, boring reason. It's just Ben Stein up there talking about NyQuil, and he's just meh, 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 meh. Okay, he might have good reasons, but it's not fun to listen to. So if you spice it up with a little bit of rhetoric, a little bit of humor, a turn of phrase, whatever, I think that's actually really good, effective public speaking. I think that's profound. The problem is when it's all the medium and it's not the message. It's all rhetoric and there's no reason behind it. So what is it about cynics? What they do is they communicate through the vehicle of humor. The vehicle of humor. Yeah, some of my favorite public speakers are stand-up comedians. Patton Oswalt, George Carlin, Bill Hicks. I mean, I could go right on down the line. It turns out they're all atheists, by the way, so figure that out. But boy, they have really just criticizing critiques of Christianity. And I'll listen to them. And you know, I've been studying about this for a long time. And so I'm like, I know that's not true. And those aren't good reasons. And that's a non sequitur. And that's not it's illogical what they're saying. But I can't activate that part of my brain when I'm belly laughing. And the same is true for the cynic. They just use laughter. They use wit. They use scoffing. They use all these sorts of things, like a well-timed eye roll, that as soon as someone is getting to their point, they look over at you and, you know, what is this, second grade? I mean, that is the use of rhetoric. Why should we not be cynical? Because it requires virtual omniscience. Omni, that prefix means all, and science means knowledge. So all-knowing, virtual. To be a cynic, you need to be virtually all-knowing. And humans simply do not have the mental faculties to be all-knowing. I don't know if you knew that. Paul says, with regard to judging motives, he says, I don't care, in 1 Corinthians 4:3, I don't care if you judge me or if I'm judged by any human court. Indeed, I don't even judge myself. But wait until the Lord comes, and he will reveal the motives of men's hearts. Paul says that he's not only disqualified from having the cognitive faculty to judge other people's motives, but because, in the words of Jeremiah 17:9, his heart is so deceitful and wicked, he can't even judge his own. His bias is so strong, he can't judge his own motives. He needs to rely on the Holy Spirit to reveal that, Psalm 139. He needs to rely on Christian community to reveal that, Hebrews 3:13. He needs to rely on the Scriptures to reveal that. Not that he's the judge over the Scriptures, but the Scriptures are the judge over him, Hebrews 4:12. So Paul says we don't have the ability to do that. Only God does. It's as if, to the cynic, that there will come a day in the future when all the motives and all the motivations and all the selfishness and conceit and deceit and all of this is going to be revealed at the great judgment day. And to the cynic, there will be no surprises. They know it all right now. Virtual omniscience. The cynic refuses to be cynical of his or her own cynicism. They love to put people, organizations, authorities, grandma, grandpa, mom, dad, brother, sister, friend, pastor, policeman, governor, teacher, whoever, doesn't matter. They love to put everyone under the microscope and watch them 24/7, but they will never have the intellectual integrity to turn that back around on their own motives, on their own motivations. And indeed, we see that cynics become very tender when you start to press on their hidden values, their hidden purpose in life. They don't like that at all. They like to critique everyone out there. And it's basically to keep the focus on everyone. But once that turns around, they're in deep trouble. To put this a different way, the cynic never doubts his doubts. He never is suspicious of his own suspicions. He never questions his own interpretation. It's as though he himself is infallible. From the Latin fallere, to lie, to deceive. He can't deceive. He can't be wrong in his own personal understanding of the events and interpretation of the events in question. Again, Dick Keyes, he says, we don't think to question cynicism when it is all around us. We don't see our eyeglasses. We only see everything else through them. That's insightful. Like, imagine, I remember being a kid, eighth grader. I wanted to be, don't laugh. I wanted to be Bono from U2, okay? I said, don't laugh. I deliberately said, don't laugh. And then you laughed, and then you pointed, and then you whispered in each other's ear. I wanted to be Bono from U2. So he had those cool sunglasses. So I always had these blue sunglasses, you know? And when I said eighth grade, I really meant senior year of high school. So I had these blue sunglasses, and I thought that they were really cool and everything. And when you walked around, everything was blue. You know, it was just like, whoa, this is like a whole new world. This is great. And what Keyes is saying is that if you're in that realm where all you have is the sunglasses on, you see everything in that way. You see a group of friends, and all of a sudden, you know, one perspective, one interpretation would be those are friends. They really love each other. They've been together for a long time. Maybe in the context of Christian community, they have God at the center. And that's authentic. That's real. But to the cynic, they look at that and they say, oh, those girls, they're high school girls. They'll grow out of that. You know, they're really into Christianity. It's just a phase. That's all that is. Some kind of a boy is going to get in the midst of things, going to rip them apart. And, you know, if you just pressed on that a little bit, you would just see that's phony. What about family, marriage, parenting? You know, some people have been so hurt by abusive parents, abusive grandparents, abusive aunts and uncles, parental figures. Then all of a sudden they see something like this, a picture of, you know, how sweet is that? You know, dad helping his son ride a bike for the first time. How sweet is that? And one person could see that, but to the cynic, that's just, they see that through those lenses. They can't help it. You know, that dad is really, you know, that's a nice slice of the puzzle there. Yeah, but normally I bet he yells at that kid. And I heard that dad even reads the Bible to his son. He's basically indoctrinating his son to become a Christian. Yeah, and I heard that dad signed him up for the youth group camp. Oh, yeah, so he like really is like controlling his son and brainwashing his son. And he doesn't really love his son at all. You see what I'm saying? These interpretations can spiral into an immense rolling ball of confusion. What about this? Could it even be that Christians together at a Bible study could be wearing the cynical glasses? No. Not in the body of Christ, please. You're telling me that you could be sitting there in a meeting of prayer and you could be sitting there just judging the crap out of that person across the room? You know, yeah, so apparently he's praying now. Oh, yeah, I don't think he even really believes this. Oh, there she is again. Yeah, she's amening every prayer. Was she going to never amen a prayer? It's like, who's she trying to impress? Oh, I remember that boy over there. She's trying to get a date with him. Oh, why is it that all of a sudden he started to date and now he's starting to get really involved with the prayer meeting? And it's just like, you're here to pray. That's what you're here to do. Good Lord. Well, pain, as I said, pain is most often at the core of cynicism. It's reported that George Carlin, toward the end of his life in 2007, gave an interview where he said this. He said, scratch any cynic and you will find a disappointed idealist. George Carlin was one of the most cynical people that there was. I've listened to all of his albums back to front. I saw him before he died in concert. And cynical, fun. Not like Bill Maurer, I guess, was more cynical than George Carlin. But George Carlin's actually funny. So, like, he's got that going for him. I figure, like, if you're going to be a cynical atheist, like, at least be funny, you know? George Carlin, nobody better than him. But in this moment of honesty, he said the cynicism springs from broken ideals, that reality crashed into idealism and the ideals just smashed apart. This is human nature. We have a certain proclivity, an inclination, you could say, toward the negative, toward the suspicious. Then you throw us into a fallen world, not just with a fallen nature, but a fallen world, and we get battered and bruised and beaten up. And that is a toxic combination that can only be rescued and healed by the power of the Holy Spirit. So, for example, check this out. Zarush Fizoji, he was a data scientist at MIT. He did a study in 2018 where he studied the inception of Twitter in 2006 all the way to 2017. He studied 126,000 news stories that were tweeted or retweeted on Twitter. And these were retweeted 4.5 million times in total. And he checked these stories, their veracity or truthfulness, with, quote, 6 independent fact-checking organizations that exhibited 95 to 98% agreement. That's pretty good to have 6 independent fact-checking organizations coming together to say, yeah, that was a true story and that was a false story. That was propagated. That never happened. What did he find? Falsehoods were 70% more likely to be retweeted than the truth. even when controlling for the account age, activity level, and number of followers and followees of the original tweeter. He refers to this on page 1151 as the novelty hypothesis, that when you see something that's novel or new, think of the porno addict. They're constantly looking for something new or novel to look at, and that the things that were sexually stimulating yesterday aren't today because there's a diminishing return. And so too, with the news, to look at something that's, and some of these were rank. I mean, some of these were just so obviously false that you just couldn't believe it, but they were being retweeted like crazy. And it's because they have novelty. To repost something like that just gave a certain excitement. Bozoghi found this. He said the specific types of news that would be forwarded and retweeted on social media, check this out. At the top of the list, those which were most likely to be spread were those which precipitated surprise, disgust, and fear, and those which were least likely to be viewed or retweeted were those which spoke of joy and trust. One reporter I listened to, she said, you know, every day we would come into the newsroom and we would see up on the wall the stats, and whenever we had a story that was really surprising, disgusting, fearful, you know, the ratings would shoot up. And then when we did the story about the philanthropist or the fireman getting the kitty out of the tree or the social justice or whatever, that the ratings would go down. And that is not an indictment on the media. That's an indictment on us. This is human nature. That's my point. Julia Baum from Humboldt University says this, spontaneous likability, deliberate person judgments, and emotional person evaluation were strongly influenced by negative information. Here's the kicker. Yet remarkably unaffected by the trustworthiness of the information. So if it was negative, that influenced you more than if it was even true. You could be believing something about someone knowing that there's no evidence for that, but because it's so negative, it's kind of like that movie Inception, where it spreads into your mind and all of a sudden you just can't stop thinking about it. Our findings demonstrate a tendency for strong emotional evaluations and person judgments, even when they are knowingly based on unclear evidence. Now, how could that be? It could be because we have a personal inclination toward negativity, toward suspicion. This leads to loneliness. Why would this lead to loneliness? Well, because it feels like with your friend who's a cynic, it feels like you're walking through the cynical minefield, is what I'll call it. Do you have any idea how scary that would be to be a soldier? You know, carving through with your knife, your metal detector to try and find landmines that could be literally 6 inches from your face. This is how it feels to be around the cynic. You sit around the cynic. You know, I wonder how they're going to interpret what I just said. I wonder what they're going to say about what I just did. We've heard that expression, walking on eggshells. Yeah, walking on a minefield is better. Because you might take a step and they're okay with that. And you might take another step and they're okay with that. And then all of a sudden, boom! You landed on that one thing and you're amazed at how they can twist your words, twist your motives, and all of a sudden you get yourself thinking, like, is that really what I came in to say? Well, this creates tension in friendships. I hope you realize that. In your friendships, why is there such tension? Why am I at the center of controversy? It's because I'm sitting there judging the daylights out of this other person, and whenever they're trying to move toward me, that inhibits closeness. That stops intimacy. When I'm constantly on trial, when I'm wondering, I wonder how you're going to take this, what I'm going to say. This becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the cynic says, you don't really love me. I can't really trust you. And so then what happens? As a result, because they put out those words, they constantly are coming in with judgment and suspicion, it leads the other person to step away. This only ratifies their cynicism in the first place. This is what we might call a survival strategy. You know, when you're in dangerous situations, cases of abuse, cases of trauma, you need to come up with strategies just to survive. Now you're in the body of Christ. And God will start to put his finger on some of these sinful strategies, where at the time it was okay just to get out alive, you know what I mean, to make it through the pain and the hurt and the betrayal and the ways that you closed off your heart and the ways that you wouldn't move toward people. That's okay. But now God is saying, I've got you in a better place. Jesus is your refuge. He is your shield. He is your life. He will protect you. He will get you through this. And so now these strategies that you once used of cynicism, suspicion, doubt, blowing up, withdrawing, all of a sudden, God's like, I don't want that for you. Why? Because it does protect you from the hurt. The problem is it makes you completely numb. So you trade one agony for another. Cynicism is unloving. This is unloving to sit there holding your loved ones and your friends and your family in constant suspicion and doubt. That is a sin. To be sitting there judging people's motives day in, day out. That is a sin. That's what we would call that. That's the word for it. Sin. That's what it is. It's fundamentally unloving to do this. What does the Bible have to say about cynicism? It says in 1 Corinthians 13:7, love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, endures through every circumstance. The cynic would say the complete opposite. Love gives up immediately. It always loses faith. It's never hopeful. It never endures through circumstances. It gets out as quickly as possible. 1 Peter 4:8, most important of all, that's emphatic language, emphasis. Most important of all, continue to show deep love, agapeo, for one another. For love, agape, covers a multitude of sins. Do you see what that's saying? Show deep love for one another because love covers a multitude of sins. This is assuming that as we go to show deep love for other people, people will hurt us. People are going to hurt you. In Christian community, yes, in Christian community. When you put a bunch of sinners like us in the same room and you get us close to each other, yeah, it even makes it worse where we actually have to work through our problems rather than just be skeptical and withdrawn and insulated from one another. Yeah, there's going to be problems. Yes, there's going to be hurt. Let's turn to the Proverbs for some wisdom here. The scoffers, the lisim is the term here. Alan Ross states that the scoffer, the lis is, quote, the defiant and cynical free thinker, the scoffer. So when you see that in the New American Standard Bible, that's what it means. The scoffer is, quote, the person who will not live by wise and moral teachings and is not content to let others do so without his cynical mocking. Let's do a little study here on what the Proverbs say. Proverbs 1:22, scoffers delight themselves in the law of the Lord. No, that's what David said in Psalm 1. They delight themselves in the Bible. Scoffers, the lisim, they delight themselves in their own scoffing. They just love this. It perpetuates off itself. Proverbs 22:10, you drive out the scoffer and contention will go out with him. Oh yeah, almost like it's like a social contagion. You get the scoffer right in the middle, spewing all of their cynicism all over everybody. And we're social creatures. And so then all of a sudden we start thinking hateful things about each other and withdrawing or blowing up. And then all of a sudden the scoffer leaves and all of a sudden there's peace. That must have been a coincidence. Proverbs 21:24. Scoffers are proud and haughty and they act with boundless arrogance. The sin of pride, the premier sin. The premier sin, that is the scoffer. Yes, this is a sin, to sit there in judgment of people's motives. Proverbs 29:8, scoffers set a city aflame, but the wise turn away anger. How about this? Proverbs 9:12, if you scoff at wisdom, you will be the one to suffer. See, that's the sad part here. This is the verbal form. If you scoff, if you're cynical toward wisdom, who hurts? You. You hurt. That's who. Well, in our final minutes here together, how can we overcome cynicism? Because this is something that begins in the mind and the heart, we need to do what Paul says in Romans 12 to have a transforming of the mind. So at the end of the day, the heart of the issue is the issue of the heart. And without going through this avenue, we're just going to be behaving differently. That's it. For one, we want to remind ourselves whenever we're feeling this pull towards cynicism that God alone has the right to be cynical. He's the one who is truly omniscient. Psalm 147 says his knowledge is infinite, infinitely knowing, all knowing. Jesus could see through the phoniness of his day. Remember in Mark 7, Isaiah 29, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Jesus loved quoting that. Why did he love to do that? Because he could see right through the religious phoniness, the fakiness. And read Matthew 6 sometime when he's talking about the Pharisees, all these real religious men. He said, yeah, they got their reward in full. Keep the change, guys. You pray in public and you do this in public. You love the greetings in the public. Read his excoriating words in Matthew 23 sometime for Jesus seeing the phoniness in religion. He also sees the problems in the church. You know, I'm one of the pastors around here. I get to see a lot of the problems. Man, we got problems. We have got problems in this church. And sometimes after these meetings, you're trying to lead. You're trying to figure out how we can get through this and how we can bring people together, how we can get vision. And man, sometimes you just feel that wet slime. There's problems here. Jesus sees those problems. He sees all the problems. Revelation 2 and 3, it says that he's walking among the lampstands. It says that he holds all the lampstands in his right hand. That the church is literally in the hand, in the palm of Jesus Christ. And he walks through the churches and he comes in and speaks to the issues. And he knows what he's talking about. He sees the problems. He knows everything. He sees the phoniness. He sees the issues. And yet he refuses to be cynical toward us. How dare I be cynical toward a loved one? How dare I be cynical toward you if God over here is saying, I actually have the right to do that and I refuse to do so? The goal here is realism. It isn't optimism. It isn't pessimism. It's realism. According to the Bible, we're not supposed to be gullible children, according to Ephesians 4. That's not the issue here. Gullibility is a bad thing. Many of us are so far away from gullibility, though. That's the problem. And the alternative is not to be pessimistic. That's not going to help anything. That's bad too. It's to be realistic. Jesus was the one who said to beware of people when he sent out the 12 in Matthew chapter 10. But he also says in that same chapter, verse 31, but do not fear them. Do not fear how they're going to hurt you. Beware. Be on your guard. But don't let it turn into withdrawing from others. Part of transformation of the mind with cynicism is to be suspicious of Satan. If there's anyone to be suspicious of, it's Satan, the evil one. Satan was the original cynic. He's the one who is spinning God's words, twisting God's motives. Oh, he said that, but is that really what he meant? And omitting certain parts, adding certain parts, the temptation, Luke 4 and Matthew 4. He's twisting Psalm 91, and you should really do this. And God, why don't you turn this into bread? And that's the original cynic, is Satan. So next time you're feeling cynical, you need to think to yourself, I am thinking like Satan. I am thinking like Satan. This does not come from God. God has the right to be cynical. Satan does not have the right. He has taken that right, and he's spewing this all over us. He exploits pride. 1 Timothy 3:6. That's why we got to wait to recognize leaders, because they could be filled with conceit and then get the condemnation of the devil, as Paul says. So when I'm feeling like I'm such a big deal, I'm such a hotshot, and why isn't anyone recognizing this? And there must be a problem around here with all these different people. They can't see it. You need to realize that's something that Satan would say. He accuses us to each other. He's called the accuser of the brethren. Diabolos, to throw against. Yeah. The guy who led me to Christ basically pulled me out of a gutter, taught me everything I know, taught me how to teach, how to work with people, got me through my horrible introversion, depression. And, basically just, you know, I would not be here. At a certain point, I was asked to teach one of our big meetings, our central teachings, and he wasn't. And I started to develop this mindset. I started to think that he was jealous of me. Because he would make these little comments and stuff, you know, why are we doing it that way? And we had disagreement and stuff between leaders. And I had developed this case. I was starting to realize this is... he's jealous. And then here was the coup de grace, or as my dad would say, the coup de grace. Years went by, and I was asked to come on staff here at our church. And I thought, oh no, this is just going to make it worse. He's already feeling jealous. And so I was sitting down to lunch with them after I'd heard about it, and one of my really extroverted friends just blurts out, "I heard you're going to be working for the church. That's wonderful, James. That's amazing." I just melted. I just felt like, oh my God, here we go. I looked up at him. He looked me right in the eye. He said, "Wow." He said, "You know, I've been telling people for years behind your back that you should have that job." I realized he wasn't jealous of me. I was jealous of him. Tears were shed. The accuser of the brethren. Yeah. How could it be this guy who did nothing but show love and affection and help? How could it be I could build such a developed case? I wouldn't put it past my sinful nature. But we do know from Scripture there is an accuser out there. He's prowling around. And he can fuel resentment and anger. We're in a Christian community here. You know what the old joke is? If you ever find a perfect church, don't join it because you'll ruin it. Yeah, we got problems here. We got a group full of sinners. We got problems. Was that perfectly handled right? No, it wasn't. Should he have said it that way? Should she have done it that way? No, they shouldn't have done it that way. They apologized. They sought for forgiveness. They moved toward reconciliation. Yeah, all that. What Satan can do is actually fuel the resentment and the anger. Like the guy in 2 Corinthians 2, that guy. He was the one who was, you know, they had removed from the church. They had to take such a stand. And then the church in Corinth was, you know, really soft on that. And then they were like, no, they're being too harsh. They wouldn't let him back in. And Paul says, forgive him. Unless you're going to fall prey to the schemes of Satan. So often we pray, you know, God, I pray that Satan would be bound. Meanwhile, we're holding on to unrighteous anger and unforgiveness and resentment and bitterness in our heart. How about forgiving? How about moving toward reconciliation? How about blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God? Not giving Satan a foothold. Number four, crushing cognitive distortions. How about this? You just think about this. Get this out in the open. You know, I was betrayed in the past. Yes, you were betrayed. Yes, that did happen. So what's your move? What are you going to do? You were hurt. You were betrayed. I've been betrayed here. I've been hurt. I've been name called. I've had people talk by my back, gossip about me, lie about me. That's happened to me too. Yeah, that's happened. I was betrayed. So now what am I going to do? What am I going to do about that? Well, because I was betrayed in the past, I'm not going to love others in the present. Somebody over here 10 years ago said the wrong thing to me and hurt my feelings. And so now this person has never done a single thing to me. I'm going to hold them hostage. I'm going to hold them under trial. And I'm going to either withdraw or I'm going to punish them for something that he did a decade ago. Are you kidding me? I was betrayed in the past, so I'm going to punish people who have never hurt me in the present. I'll withdraw or relate on a functional level. That's what we got a lot of in this church. People who are still functioning, they're still showing up, they still smile, but what's missing? It's a closing of the heart. To open up your heart to other people. Yeah, I was hurt, and the instinct is to close that up. But when you open that back up, you start to see that the relationships become even better. People sense that the love is real. And we need to let go of that. We need to forgive that. And we need to move toward others in love. Other people are cynical, you know, because they've tried, but they failed. They've tried to work with a young Christian, and that person has burned them. They've tried to lead a group. That didn't work. They've tried any number of different ministries in the church, and it failed, and it was public. That's happened. I failed. I failed publicly. I felt so bad, humiliating stories. I mean, real bad. That'll be XSI next year. It'll just be a list of humiliating stories. I really tried, but I failed. So what's your move? What are you going to do? Change your theology. I don't really believe in discipleship anymore. Didn't work. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. Nobody questions it. It's as clear as day. Go and make disciples. The only imperative in the Great Commission is make disciples. The rest are participles that build off of make disciples. Jesus said, make disciples. I don't believe that anymore. Why? Because somebody burned me. That's why. I don't really believe in every member Christian community. Why? Well, because one of our home churches, you know, fizzled. Does the Bible really teach every member ministry? Changing your theology because you're hurt. Can't tell you. It's like clockwork. Someone must be to blame. I don't know why I was put in this situation. I don't know who put me here. I told them at the time, I told them this was not a good idea, and this is bad, and I was set up for failure, and so you failed, and now we're just going to sit there and finger point. I'm sure if you succeeded, you'd be saying, oh, it was all them who set me up for success. I'm sure that's what you'd be saying. No, this only happens when we have failure. Or I will just set my goals so low that I can't possibly fail. I'm never going to try that again. I'm not saying I'm never going to serve. I'm never saying I'm never going to do things. I'm just, it's going to be so minimalistic that I'm just not even going to really try. And I'm just going to be a nice guy, good, nice Christian guy, never really have any aspirations, ambitions anymore. Why would I continue to open my heart to others if I could get hurt again? Because God promises to be with you. Period. End of discussion. Well, I was hurt. I failed. Yeah, God says you can go out again. You can open up your heart again. Why? Because he says he'll be right there. You don't need to worry. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. Finally, and this is the most practical step I could give, is just to give yourself in love despite how you feel. And may I add, and until you feel. When I show up to that prayer meeting, and I'm there, and I'm going into cynical mode, and I'm judging. I got to start opening up my mouth, amening other people's prayers. I need to start opening up my mouth and praying, even when I don't feel like it, especially when I don't feel like it. When I show up to a meeting of believers, I don't know how people do it, where they sit there week in, week out. They never speak up. They never share. They never talk. They just sit there. You just sit there. You know how cynical I would feel if I just sat there and didn't participate? It'd be terrible. You have to throw yourself. You only get anything out of this by what you put into it. And what you'll start to see is that over time, as you start to act in love, then you start to get the feelings of love. Because people can sense when you really love them. And all of a sudden, reciprocity occurs, where they start to see a warmth and a love, that you believe in all things, that you're enduring, you're hopeful, and then all of a sudden they feel that in return. And they start giving that back. And yes, there's going to be pain. There's going to be hurt. That's going to happen. This is the way. This is the way of Jesus. He was the one who modeled it. He knew what was in the heart of man, but it didn't stop him from withdrawing.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.